Let's talk about solar energy in Virginia and what we can do with it. My name is John Flannery, and I am active in the Virginia Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And we decided that in Virginia, we had to look at what this meant to Virginia with farms agriculture and with farms proposed to be solar farms. The overriding question we ask is, what must we do for solar development to assure environmental quality and conform with the tried and true rural Virginia values? We had a panel discussion on just this subject with leaders in the field with diverse views because it's considered controversial, and we wanted to find a way to discuss this in an intelligent, respectful manner, because this is both a challenge and a promise for Virginia and elsewhere in the United States. We have several outstanding speakers, and the moderator who's going to control the flow of the panel is Scott Cameron. He's the vice chair of the Northern Virginia Soil and Water Conservation District. Now, Scott is a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration and a member of the Virginia State Water Control Board. Scott has a uniquely broad governmental perspective, having worked as both a career civil servant and a political appointee in the federal government at the Department of Interior. He's also worked as staff to the governor of California and as a congressional staffer. And as you can see, he therefore brings to it the kind of background and talent to both understand, to inform, and to help us enact a program that will do justice to this emerging technology, still emerging and becoming more universal every day. So, without further ado, let me introduce Scott.
Let's get on with it. So, this is what's been happening in terms of the acreage of solar energy in Virginia over the last several years. If I remembered my high school algebra, I could have done a linear regression here and figured out what the slope of that line looks like. But suffice to say, solar energy in terms of acreage is growing fast in Virginia. We were at about 3,000 acres in 2016, and we're up to around 40,000 acres permitted. This is Virginia Department of Energy data that we're looking at here. So where is the solar? It's predominantly in the south-central and south-eastern parts of the state. In terms of congressional districts, I think we're looking at Bob Good's congressional district, sort of in the middle here, and McClellan, to a large extent, Jack McClellan, over there in the southeast. Interestingly, there's relatively little in Area 2, relatively little in the northern part of the state more generally. Okay, relevant considerations. The Virginia Clean Economy Act says we should have 16,000 megawatts of solar energy in the Commonwealth by 2035. That's roughly the equivalent of 16 nuclear power plants worth of solar energy. Virginia is supposed to be completely fossil-free in terms of generation by 2050. In northern Virginia, Loudoun County, Prince William in particular, we have an expansion of data centers that absorb an enormous amount of energy, and they are demanding renewable energy. So it's entirely possible that the renewable energy footprint in Virginia will exceed that 16,000 acres contemplated in the Virginia Clean Economy Act. How many acres does it take to have a megawatt of solar? The average, based on the statistics from the State Department of Energy, suggests that it takes around 12 acres. DEQ estimates 10 acres per megawatt of solar. Dominion told me yesterday that Dominion Energy assumes 8 acres per megawatt. So you're looking somewhere between 8 and 12 acres of land per 1 megawatt. One of the implications of that for 16,000 megawatts, we could be looking at somewhere around 300,000 acres of land gone into solar energy in Virginia based on DEQ estimates. As a point of comparison, Shenandoah National Park is 200,000 acres, and as you can see, Loudoun and Prince William are essentially the same acreage or close to the acreage that would be covered by solar. So what are the alternatives, perhaps, to using farmland or forest land for solar? Back in 2016, the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, estimated that rooftop solar could generate around 40% on a national average of our electric generation needs. Of course, Virginia is not Arizona. It's not Michigan. National averages maybe aren't very meaningful, but rooftop solar could make some sort of significant contribution, it's fair to say. Whether it's 20% or 40%, who knows? Dominion Energy will tell you, though, that trying to balance an electrical grid with 5,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 generators is a lot more complex than if you're balancing an electrical grid with 10 large power plants. So Dominion indicates there are really significant infrastructure issues with widespread distributed solar. Okay, the Virginia Commonwealth University says we're using about 61% of the land that's going into solar is coming out of farmland. I think that's interesting statistics. The State Department of Energy says we have taken more than 10,000 acres of Virginia's forests so far and put it into solar farms. Interestingly, We heard about the 2025 targets that Virginia has under the Chesapeake Bay Agreement, WIP 3. Virginia is supposed to deliver 48,000 new acres of forest. We've done less than 7,000 acres so far. So we are at negative 4,000 acres, if you will, in terms of what we owe the rest of the states in the Chesapeake drainage in terms of forest land cover. One interesting statistic, DEQ reported a couple of weeks ago that 69% of utility-scale solar in Virginia right now is out of compliance with the state water requirements one way or another. So what does that mean? Really, it means erosion and stormwater management. If you don't have vegetation under solar panels, then guess what? You get erosion. If you build a solar facility on a steep slope, guess what? You get erosion. You essentially can have a gutter effect coming off of a solar panel if they aren't designed correctly and they're not on devices that let them go vertical during a rainstorm. So some interesting topics, a lot going on. I will stop now and I'll hand it over to our next speaker, and that Skylar with you. So however you'd like to handle it.
Skylar Zunk is also a member of our panel. He's the CEO of Energy Right Virginia. Skylar brings a span of government, nonprofit, campaign, and private sector experience to his part in founding Energy Right in the Commonwealth. Recently, Skylar worked for Conservatives for Clean Energy, Virginia, and served as Director of Operations on Delegate Kirk Cox's bid for governor. This blend of background helps him form the policies and recommendations he has. Welcome, Skylar.
Well, hi, everybody. My name is Skylar Zunk. Privilege for me to be up here with Scott. When Scott was Assistant Secretary at the Department of the Interior, I was a plain old assistant and really enjoyed meeting him and a whole lot of other experts up in Washington during my service to the DOI. That's when I first got interested in energy policy. I have a background in conservative politics and government service at Washington, D.C. And about a year ago, I founded Energy Right to bring a conservative voice to the clean energy conversations happening across Virginia. A lot of you all are very well aware that solar is coming quickly, and it is a topic of great interest to a lot of counties across the state. We are in about 50 counties working to educate leaders, boards of supervisors, planning commissioners, the business community, and regular old citizens to elevate the conversations surrounding solar energy development generally. There's an incredible amount of misinformation that is rampant across Virginia that does not do anyone a good service. We think that when the conversations are elevated, when folks are talking about well-researched, fact-based research and opinions, that the rural Virginia landscape regarding solar will be a whole lot better. We think that solar energy can be an incredible winning issue for rural communities if it's done properly. We're trying to educate what those best practices are with solar development and try to make the playing field as level as we possibly can as solar becomes a larger and larger part of our clean energy portfolio in Virginia. Like I said, we're in about 50 counties. We'll talk with anybody, any organization that wants to learn about solar. We'll host our own community meetings. We will present at board meetings, at Chamber of Commerce meetings. We will get out to wherever we possibly can to bring our message and bring our education and resources to communities that need it. I'd like to touch a little bit on the solar policy that Virginia Association of Solar Water Conservation Districts has put out. Maybe add a little bit of a nuance and some of our organization's thoughts to that, but I thought it'd be useful to analyze why we're here. Why is solar such a big topic across Virginia that this organization and a number of other organizations are looking into? And my main answer to that would be the market. Utility-scale solar is the cheapest way to put an electron onto the grid compared to any fossil fuel or any other clean energy source. And it's incredibly cheap, and that's why companies are investing in it, and that's why you see Dominion, among other utilities, moving towards more solar. The fuel is free. Once you build a project, there are no fuel inputs for the 40 years that project sits quietly in a field producing clean energy. Scott also mentioned there's an incredible corporate demand. I've seen some stats to say that about half of the solar energy that Virginia produces right now is purchased via a power purchase agreement by a corporate entities such as Amazon, Google, Facebook, who want to consume 100% clean energy, and that is a huge part of the demand. And we're seeing utility scale specifically because it's about a third of the cost to produce that electron compared to a rooftop solar panel built on a private residence or on a flat roof business building, so to speak. Another reason you're seeing utility scales developed on greenfield sites is because a company can very easily invest in that project. It would be very difficult for folks like you and me to invest our own money into a utility scale site or enough solar on our roofs to add significant power to the grid. Solar is expensive for individuals to invest in, but when a company wants to invest millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into a utility scale size project, they're able to do so with long-term land leases or, in some cases, purchase agreements. So that's why we're seeing solar at a large scale. Yes, we have the Virginia Clean Economy Act targets to hit, but there are other states such as North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, who don't have Virginia Clean Economy type laws on the books that are producing more solar energy than we are here in Virginia. So it is market-driven, it's a cheap way to produce electricity, and it's very new to Virginia. Very rarely has Board of Supervisors ever had to vote on a energy generation project. As Scott mentioned, there's a handful of large power plants that power the majority of the grid across Virginia. Well, now you're seeing a more dispersed energy generation mix, and board supervisors are in some cases voting on projects that are worth or represent $500 million in investment. So it's a huge opportunity, it's a huge task to be had. I appreciated the portion of the policy that notes that county staffs are overworked, and these are big projects that require a whole lot of research, analysis, and attention. That's absolutely true. But I'm sure folks have heard of the Belcher Solar Project in Louisa and the runoff issues there. Has anybody heard of that project? It's quite a few hands. I'm sure folks have heard of the Essex solar facility that was constructed poorly and resulted in a lot of erosion. There are probably 8 to 10 projects that have not had those issues, that are built, are properly screened. People don't even know that they're there because they were engineered properly. The counties have the proper attention to erosion and sediment control procedures, stormwater ponds, that have made those projects phenomenal neighbors and visible neighbors and productive tax-paying entities in all of these localities. So there's a lot of good that is sometimes not appreciated. Of course, the DEQ came out last year with some updated stormwater and erosion control policies that required projects to comply with several different regulations, but the essence of that is that the water quality and quantity before a project is constructed must be the same at the end of that project's construction life to ensure that there's no change in the quantity or quality of water that comes off of that site. I think that that's a positive good. These projects aren't going to be polluting. We certainly don't think that a polluting project or an eroding project is going to ever be a good neighbor. And I think that shows a whole lot of progress and certainly some reasons to support projects. The policy also talks a little bit about carbon capture. It is difficult to wrap your mind around, but in terms of the carbon offset that a solar project can bring, it's about 150 times more carbon taking out of the atmosphere than an acre of solar forest would bring over a year period. There's a Columbia University study that delved into this, talking about the Spotsylvania solar project that was constructed a number of years ago. And in terms of carbon capture, solar projects are really good at doing that, carbon, removing carbon from the atmosphere, even compared to solar forests. And, you know, of course, we need to be very mindful of our agricultural economy and our agriculture outputs in Virginia, but they're on the rise. The governor just announced, I believe last week, that we've set record outputs and exports of a number of different agriculture products. That is phenomenal. Last year, Virginia saw a net zero conversion out of farmland use, which is another phenomenal point to raise. During that same year, probably 10,000 acres across Virginia were converted into solar. We talk a lot about property rights as a conservative organization, and talk to a lot of landowners who want to do solar leases on their lands, and they believe as private property owners, they should have the right to do with their land what they want, so long as they're not adversely affecting their neighbor. And we spend a lot of time on not adversely affecting your neighbor, making sure vegetative screenings are involved in projects that solar water concerns are at the forefront. And with all those pieces together, we think these projects can be a positive good for these rural communities and can be an important part of our energy portfolio. So I'll pause there, but looking forward to the conversation.
Zach Jacobs also joined our panel. He's a legislative specialist with the Farm Bureau. Prior to his role with the governmental relations team at Farm Bureau, Zach served as a policy advisor for a few congressmen on agriculture, transportation, national security, and energy issues, and was serving as a legislative analyst at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Glad to have you, Zach.
All right, good afternoon, good morning, everybody. My name is Zach Jacobs. I work for Virginia Farm Bureau, part of our government relations team. Similar story to these two gentlemen. Here, worked in D.C., was a political appointee at the Department of Agriculture before working on Capitol Hill, working on energy issues for a few members of the congressional delegation up there in Washington before coming down to Farm Bureau about a year ago. We have 88 county farm bureaus in Virginia that represent and make up our organization as a whole. And all of our policies that stem from the energy sector to commodities to transportation to local issues and taxes, all of those are derived from our membership. So the grassroots organization that we are, all of our members provide us the policies that then we take as the governmental relations staff to the state, local, and federal level to hopefully bring home some positive results for our membership. So I want to talk a little bit about our policies. I'm not going to read them all to you. We got 13 that directly mention solar issues and utility scale solar projects, stemming from opposing the thing called solar farms to opposing tax credits or incentivizing solar energy production or utility scale solar operations on prime farmland and forest lands to even then opposing that they be eligible for land use assessment depending on if your locality offers that. So we, again, 13 policies that are solely centered around the solar topic, and so we work with the General Assembly, the Governor's Office, and at the federal level to try and make sure that we are getting these policies accomplished. This is from the Department of Energy folks that shared with us about local ordinances around solar. You can see in the state of Virginia, this was, again, December 22, so I know some folks are still working on updating that and changing some of the ordinances around their localities. So you can see where some of these localities have chosen to take action on or against utility-scale solar. And wanted to kind of share that to give you a little bit of a blueprint where some current guidelines exist for these localities. I also got a couple slides that I take from the American Farm and Trust and their Farms Under Threat series. If you haven't tuned into this, I highly recommend it. When you look at nationally from 2001 to 2016, the amount of acres of farmland that were converted out of farmland. Now, this is not just for solar. This is not solely associated with that, just in general. And then most of that conversion was converted over to low-density residential, so your neighborhoods and your suburbs. And then the third of that converted land was nationally significant, which when we look at that, it's all about the prime ag land, prime forest land, things like that. In Virginia, in that same time frame, 340,000 acres were developed or were threatened, and 80% of that were converted against that low-density residential, those subdivisions and things like that, and then 120,000 of that were nationally significant. So again, a pretty large number that is considered prime farmland. So the Farms Under Threat series talked about the three future scenarios: business as usual, runaway sprawl, and then better built cities. And so business as usual really talks about the historical trends continuing, but not really mitigating those resources. And you can see here, as we look at the projected acres for the top 12 states, for areas that are acres that's going to be projected to be converted by 2040, given those three scenarios, and then the percentage of that being agricultural lands, again, Virginia being in the top 12 of both of those, or all three of those scenarios. And then the projected acres of utility solar, taking a look at the Department of Energy Solar's future study, as you can see, Virginia is, again, upwards there in the 100 to 200,000 range of land area that will be converted over to utility-scale solar by 2040. And from a Farm Bureau perspective, really where we're focused on is oftentimes solar developments are placed or on working farms and working forest lands. And so when you look at that, it certainly displaces jobs for farmers and foresters. And not only does it stop there, it goes into the seed dealers, the equipment dealers, and then the whole supply chain and some of these really rural localities that are their livelihood depends on the agriculture and forestry sectors. And when we look at the agriculture industry as a whole and the forestry industry combined for Virginia, we're looking at roughly around 490,000 jobs in the Commonwealth. Each one of those jobs creates 1.6 other jobs in other fields throughout the Commonwealth, which is a huge statistic that we're extremely proud of. And we have a $105 billion annual impact to the economy here in the Commonwealth. When we look at solar, so far, towards the end of the calendar year of 2022, a little over 4,700 jobs and $4.8 billion in economic impact to the Commonwealth. So when you look at agriculture, the impact is there. You just mentioned it. We're growing. Our exports are growing. The ag industry is not going anywhere in neither solar. So our job is to really help make sure our members are equipped with all the information that they need to make right decisions as it kind of pertains to their land use and their operations.
Judy Dunscombe is a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy. Judy leads multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder teams at state, regional, and national scales to develop and implement strategies that can address pervasive environmental challenges faced by people, including those associated with the management of water, of energy resources, and climate change.
Judy, you're up.
All right. Thanks. My name is Judy Dunscombe. I am the senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy in Virginia, based here in Charlottesville. Nature Conservancy is a global organization, but we've had roots in Virginia here for 60 years. I have been working on energy siting issues for, 20 years maybe, since I was 12. And it started off thinking about wind energy in the mountains, but I've also worked on natural gas extraction and solar energy development now, and offshore wind actually, in Virginia. And although I am but one here in our Charlottesville office, I have a cadre of colleagues that are working on this issue around the world. So literally Mongolia, India, Pacific Islands, South America, all on this same question, which is how do we deploy the renewable energy that we need to power and feed our planet while protecting the lands and waters that we all need to survive? Because it is clearly a competition for space. Renewable energy, we know, takes a lot of land area in order, or water area. And all energy, all forms of energy development have impacts. There's no getting around that. So when thinking about this issue a few years ago, I started wondering, well, how hard is it? Like, just take Virginia for a moment. How hard is it to find space for all the different things we want to do, or at least a couple of different things we want to do with our landscape? So I worked with a young woman, Nina Copeland, who's a recent grad from the University of Virginia, to create this model. I call it my super simple solar model. So what it is a model of where it's sort of technically feasible to site solar energy development. You can't just plonk solar energy down anywhere. But the things, I think most of us think that it's the sunlight that's the limiting factor, but actually what's the limiting factor is the distance to the transmission line. It's the cost of building that interconnection that is a significant driver. So what we did here is we mapped, these are all the transmission lines in Virginia, we mapped up to a distance of up to 3 miles, which is kind of the economic, and some projects go a little further out, but in general this works pretty well. And then we eliminated some things that were obviously unsuitable, open water, already built environment, we took that out, and another important issue is slope, because solar kind of needs to be laid on a relatively flat surface if the land is deeply pitched, and that requires a lot of grading, which increases the civil cost of the project. So again, slope is kind of important. So 50% or lower is what we use. Some people, Dominion indicated that was a little high, but others thought it was okay. So anyway, what you can see here is this general pattern where in the eastern part of the state, Piedmont Coastal Plain, it's really distance to transmission that dictates where solar is going to go. And in the western part of the state, it's really terrain that dictates where solar is going to go. So when we put all that together, we find that we have 8.7 million acres-ish, and all models are wrong, but some are useful. So I'm not going to swear by this number, but it's a pretty good number. And we tested this against proposed solar facilities. We did the model, and something like 92% of them fall within the model area. So we're pretty sure that this overestimates the actual technically developable area for solar in Virginia, because there's also this very important factor of, is there room in the transmission line for the energy that is being generated to fit and be transmitted? But that made it not simple, so we couldn't do that. But anyway, it's a pretty decent figure. So then we asked ourselves, okay, so what about other stuff that we want to do with that land? And we used a layer, it's kind of a long layer, but it was the best layer for what we wanted to do, because we wanted to look at conservation priority lands. And the Nature Conservancy's primary focus is biodiversity conservation. That's my phone ringing in the corner, please ignore it. The groups such as you all, the Department of Forestry, battlefield conservation groups all have valid interests in the conservation of lands for scenic resources, for production of food and fiber, et cetera. So we wanted a data set that represented all of those interests. So we overlaid that conserved Virginia layer, it's called, with our potentially solar suitable area. And we found that we got about 2 million acres of overlap. All this is available online, by the way, and I can make sure you all have access to it. So I did some really simple math. So I said if we have about 8.7 million acres of potentially solar suitable, and we've got about 2.2, that's important for conservation, we know that all those numbers are wrong. So let's, oh, wait, I think it's 6.4, but we know that all those numbers are wrong. Sorry, I keep getting my punchline too fast. All right, so, and then as Valerie mentioned, the Virginia Clean Economy Act is suggesting that we've got about 16,000 megawatts that are in the public interest, and you can bump that up to 161 acres. I use the 10 acres per megawatt. Okay, so let's say the stuff is really wrong. Let's say that I way overestimated what's potentially suitable, and I way underestimated what's important for conservation. We only have half of that that's potentially developable. And then let's say that this is a totally wrong figure, and we double it, just to make sure that we have enough, you know, that we're estimating the right amount. We still have 10 times as much land as we need to deploy the solar, right? So common sense would dictate that this should be a solvable problem. Of course, we don't live in a world where common sense dictates as much as we might like, and so what we're seeing still is a lot of conflict between solar development and things that we want to see happen, and things that we want to see happen. So my job, is to work with folks like those people here in this room, who I'm really excited to have this conversation, figure out how do we reduce the conflicts that are still happening, even though on paper, you know, we really have enough space. So a couple of ideas about how to reduce some of those conflicts. One of them is, Zach was mentioning preferring to see solar sited on mine sites and brownfields, and that is a great idea. So this map shows the overlap between the brownfields and mine sites. The brownfield layer is a little suspect to me. It needs a lot of things. Some of those are quarries, and they're not really suitable. There's lots of things going on. But in the southwest part of the state, we're very confident that those formerly coal mine sites are actually potentially good sites for solar. And the Nature Conservancy is working with Dominion, with SunTribe, and then actually Department of Energy, Virginia Energy, and another developer, Antares, are working together to put in a proposal to Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, to look at getting some funding for some projects so we can get proof of concept of what it takes to really build a project on my land. And you're not a my land crowd, but I'll just say that gets a little tricky, because once that land is mined and then put back together, there's all kinds of inconsistencies in the substrate, and it's just difficult. There's some civil costs that are higher and difficult to manage. So I guess my big conclusion here is that we can get a chunk of what we want on these brownfields and mine land sites, but we're not going to brownfield or mine land our way out of this problem. We are still going to need utility scale development, and some of that is going to happen on greenfields. So like, that is part of my overarching point. But then I'm going to switch over to this other question about distributed generation. Scott mentioned a statistic around this in the National Renewable Energy Lab did a study, plus a model, but they did a study looking at rooftop potential across the U.S. and in Virginia. They estimated that about 30% of Virginia's 2017 energy sales could be met through rooftop solar. So I think that it's important for us to explore that opportunity and that pathway further. That only accounted for buildings. It didn't account for parking lots or, you know, infill and small areas. Skyler's absolutely right when he said that type of development is far more expensive. I think that there are some ways to reduce some of the cost of entry. We also know that distributed solar in terms of job creation and price relief to energy burden communities has a bigger impact and a bigger benefit. So there may be some opportunities to incentivize that, which, again, it's not going to eliminate our need for utility scale solar, but it can take some of the pressure off. The other thing I want to mention briefly, and I think this is exactly the crowd to talk about it with, is agrivoltaics. I've been pretty skeptical about agrivoltaics because most of what we've been hearing has been like solar sheep. I heard a great talk by a young man out in Oregon who's doing some really interesting things with his family land. And with significant capital investment up front, I must say, but some really savvy management, he has an operation on a previously hay land, which he's actually renting out now to truck farmers. So he's able to generate a significant amount of electricity, get income off of that. He leases out the land for truck farm. They're working, again, with the National Renewable Energy Lab to test what crops grow well. And they're finding some really interesting things. They're finding that the solar panels are higher than normal, which costs a little more to build, but they're finding that the shading is, there's some crops that don't grow well, but there are many that do. And the shading is actually causing some improved growth because it's reducing the evaporative transpiration loss from the soil. And they're finding that both with the market vegetable crops and also with the forage that they use, they're using the pasture grasses. So they're getting really high quality pasture grasses off of that. It's not ready to take to scale yet, but NREL, as it's called, is working on some projects out west also looking at grazing, which to me, you know, cow grazing, we have a lot of that in Virginia, a lot of pasture, looking at opportunities for, again, these higher panels that cattle can graze underneath, and again, seeing some benefits to the cattle because it's cooler during the day, again, they have this higher quality forage, et cetera. So agrivoltaics are not ready for prime time yet, but I think that they're definitely worth looking into, and really look forward to seeing Virginia Tech and others pressing ahead with some bolder moves as to how we can do that, because I'm hopeful that that could be one way of sort of reducing this sort of social tension that we're experiencing between agriculture and solar development. And I appreciate what Zach said, that the ag industry isn't going anywhere and the solar industry isn't going anywhere either, and so we really got to figure out how to do together. I think I'll stop.
Well, thank you, Judy, and appreciate all the comments. Now it's your turn to ask questions. So questions from the floor. Okay, hand one up in the back real fast. I think you've got a mic.
Yes. I didn't hear anyone mention technology improvements, just solar cell conversion. And also improvements in electric distribution or transmission, I might say, let's just say microelectrics that they have. So do you have comments on technology?
I'm not sure about transmitting energy through microwaves, if that's what you were meaning, but in terms of the technology and panels, it's improving year by year. It's potentially leveling off. We've seen prices or the effectiveness of these panels come up by 90% per dollar over the last 10 years. It's another reason that it's so cost competitive right now. I don't know that it will continue on that very steep trajectory to better technology, but it's improving every single year. There are some folks that think that within 20 years, there might be a phenomenal panel technology where you can take the panels off that are already deployed at utility scale now, maybe put those on schools, find some other cheaper, less value use for them, and use the prime real estate for the most effective technology in 15 or 20 years. I don't know that that's going to take place, but it's improving. It's already very, very cost effective now, and we're excited to see that get better over time.
Well, the rule of thumb that I remember, probably dated, is that solar cells are 30% efficient. Is that?
It might be a little less than that, and that the stat there is how much of the solar energy is being transmitted into electricity, and that sounds low, but it's relatively high. A combustion engine might only take advantage of half of the energy that there is there to use, but you're about right. I believe it's in the 20 to 30% is for most panel technologies now.
Hey, another question. Gentlemen, back there.
I have two questions. One was for the Nature Conservancy. Did you take into effect on your map all the land that's in conservation easements? Because any of them with BOF and the like would not allow solar on them, so those spots would be blanked out. The other thing is, I'd like to understand the carbon sequestration that you said happens with solar panels. I don't see how it actually captures carbon.
Okay, well, I'll say for the conservation easements, they're not in the solar layer, but they are, but I did back of the envelope calculation after the fact, and it removes less than 200,000 acres if you take that out. Now, there are other conservation lands that are legitimately off the table, so we could lower that available area.
I believe your second question was for me. I apologize if I wasn't clear. I'm happy to share the Columbia study that looks into Virginia specifically. You're right, solar panels do not sequester carbon themselves, but the study looked into what they are offsetting, the energy that they are offsetting, and the carbon that you don't need to burn to produce that electricity, solar offsetting that. I believe the stats were that an acre of panels offsets 121 to 138 tons of CO2 per year. That's an offset, not a sequestration. And a forest will sequester 0.84 tons of carbon per acre per year. And that's 150 times more carbon offset with an acre of panels versus a forest. And grasslands are a little bit different. Grasslands also are carbon sink. Some folks think they're more effective carbon sinks than forests because they store that carbon underground rather than in the vegetation that's often cleared out every 30 years.
Another question. Okay, there's one here and then there's one over here.
You made a comment about how much you're going to save. How much would that packet? I'm retired military. What if we build a system? I'm not sure what it is, a weapon system, a communication system. You've got to go end to end. So you went all the way from providing the equipment all the way to disposal. So when you're building these solar panels, it costs billions of tons of carbon just to get all the raw materials for us to even put the panels together. And then on the disposal end, what are you doing with them? Where are they going? I mean, the last I heard, they were dumping them in Africa because they couldn't find any other place to put them because they don't recycle. So what's the plan for recycling these?
Yeah, so a couple questions there. Number one, the carbon effects that folks are looking into, the mining of the raw materials and the panel creation. Even when you're taking that into account, you're putting panels on a green field, the scientists say, and I'm not one, but that carbon is made up for within the first 2 or 3 years of a panel being in the sunshine, offsetting other carbon sources on the grid. Recycling, decommissioning is a huge concern all across Virginia, and I think it's a very valid one. The Wellby Cooper Center recently, I believe last August, released best practices for Virginia localities on how to decommission these sites properly. The upfront money that you're asking of these energy companies to be able to account for all of the disposal and removal of everything on these sites after 40 years. years. After 40 years of a panel being out in the sun producing electricity, they're still producing electricity. It just might be 80% of what they were producing on day one. The recycling industry in Virginia and in the U.S. is not where it should be, but there's not a market for the recycling of panels yet. In 20 years, I think a very smart businessman will have a very successful business in recycling these panels. There are certainly some examples of American solar manufacturers, solar panel manufacturers. One's coming to mind in Ohio for solar that's recycling their own proprietary technology. By weight, panels are 80 to 90% metal and glass. The last 10% is the difficult part to recycle, that raw material. But at a certain point, it's going to be much more effective to get that raw material out of recycled panels than it will be to go mine or find those raw materials in the first place. So it's growing. It's not where it should be. But again, there's just not a market for it quite yet. Soon I'm confident there will be.
And we have a question over here.
First, I want to say mention something I read that concurs with someone who said successful farming website. This goes back to 2016. Said farms under threat 2040 shows we are on track to convert over 18 million acres of farmland and ranch land from 2016 to 2040, an area the size of South Carolina. Pretty notable. So, in thinking about that earlier, data centers and so on, I mentioned, I think it's Prince William that's getting so many data centers. It's such a big issue there that I think I read recently that even Fairfax is saying, hey, we're in a partnership here. You're so affecting our groundwater over Fairfax, mostly through data centers. And if I do business with some Amazon distribution centers, some of their millions of square feet and have panels on the top. So I wonder, maybe they are doing it, should a municipality like Prince William be mandating that data centers and so on must have solar on top of them? You know, you can't build it if you don't. And I'm from Savannah County, and we just recently passed, I think, somewhere around a million square feet of a distribution center development. And so it makes me wonder, as a board member in Savannah, I understand that's not utility scale, it's still relatively small million square feet, if we should be starting to consider mandating something like that. So interested in your thoughts.
I'll reflect a couple of things. I'm just hiring an intern, the Master of Public Policy, to work for the summer to analyze what are some of the barriers to distributed center distribution. And the question that you raised about communities, especially those with a lot of large warehouse development happening, that might be a public policy goal. So I might have to interview by September. But just a couple of examples, I would say. One example. When a few years ago, I really thought utility scale was it, and that was the one thing we should really focus on. And I did a project with some folks from the Mountain Association, which is a community development group that works out of Eastern Kentucky and the Coalfield region. And what was interesting to me is that they work with Coalfield communities where you couldn't mention solar at all a few years ago because, you know, of King Coal. And those communities are now outfitting all of their administrative buildings with solar energy because it's a net energy saving, it's a price saving, cost saving for the community. So there is a path forward for municipalities to, I don't know about mandate, but to do this as a way to reduce their own tax burden. And it's certainly within the purview of a county to require certain ordinances, a certain amount of energy needs to be developed on a site. And I think the question is, how does the economics of that work out? What I can say is that I've had investors express frustration with groups like Amazon because they can pencil out for themselves and see how there's an economic advantage that those companies are not taking on right now. So I think there's an education component also to be done.
We've got time for maybe another one or two questions. There it is. Gentlemen in the back.
Hi, thank you all for being here today. I represent to us Mike Goode on the Savannah Planning Commission. One of my counterparts, Loretta Johnson Morgan's in the back. I represent the 14th District on the Planning Commission and a lot of families from that area. We recently had a community meeting with a solar company that's looking at building about 300 acres, maybe 150 acres of solar on 300 acres of land in our community. And one of the questions that a lot of community members have, what is the direct benefit for us as the local community members? You know, we hear a lot with solar about, you know, how it helps us achieve, you know, statewide goals and things like that. But a lot of people I'm finding on the local level come to us with questions, how does this benefit me directly? So is there anything we can take back to our folks that we represent and say, this is how it directly impacts you and this community?
Phenomenal question, and one that we get very often. I'll answer your question, but one quick pushback I would put into that conversation is, what direct benefit are folks getting from the natural gas power plant 5 counties away that's powering their homes? What direct benefit are folks getting from the nuclear plant on Lake Anna that is powering the grid right now? It's a little bit different with solar because it's new and it's a big footprint in a lot of communities, but like any power generation facility, solar projects are paying a significant amount of taxes to the locality. We think that is right and we think that is good. There are a number of counties in Southside Virginia where they've seen a lot of solar development that have already lowered taxes on their residents, in some cases by 10% on real estate because they get so much income from some utility scale development. So these tax dollars are coming into the localities. It's the board supervisor's decision on how best to spend that, whether that's a tax cut, whether that's putting it towards first responders or schools. That is the best case that the most direct case that we can make for locals getting benefits to from solar projects. I'm the neighbor to a 400-acre project in Chesterfield County, and we're not going to get anything from being a direct neighbor to this project, but it's not going to be another housing development. That land's going to be preserved for 40 years. The landowners are sure that it will return to timber if they want to at the end of that project's life. And, you know, it's a very gentle, quiet land use. I can think of a number of different land uses that we would not prefer being a neighbor. Solar is one that my community in the rural corner of Chesterfield County was happy to have as a neighbor.
So let me use the moderator's prerogative and ask one question of the panel. So panelists, for each one of you, if you were, you know, God or, you know, the majority leader of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and the governor all wrapped up into one, and you could make one change in Virginia law or Virginia regulations to make solar, say, more compatible with other traditional land uses, you know, what would that be? Judy, let's start off with you. I can put you on the spot.
Yeah, I think I already set my hand on this, but I think I would, there's one thing that's already happening that I want to mention. A law that requires small renewable energy projects 150 megawatts or less to mitigate for impacts from solar energy development to 50 acres of forest, I believe it is, and
10 acres of forest.
So I'm working on that regulatory advisory panel. We have a good team for the forestry side, but we don't have a good team for the ag side. And so I think really coming up with a clear idea of what are the functions and values of the agricultural land that are getting converted that we really want to preserve, whether that's future productivity or whatever, really being super clear about that, and then figuring out what steps do we need to take in order to make sure that those functions and values are protected.
Ms. Fowler, what's your one wish list?
I don't think there would be any further government action or regulation necessarily coming from this as a small government conservative. I think the market's pretty effective. But if I could do one thing and wave a magic wand, I'd love for all energy sources to be considered and debated on a level playing field. We're an all-the-above energy organization. There are a number of different energy sources that need to be present to power our grid. We never say anything bad about any sort of electricity or energy generation. I think solar is getting an unfair shake in a lot of areas, and I wish communities were a little bit better educated on the facts surrounding solar development. That's what we've set out to do. It's an enormous task, and I think a level playing field for all energy to compete fairly, recognizing we need a diverse grid, would be my one wish.
I've touched on this quite a bit, but I would say for us and from the Farm Bureau perspective, the process of which these solar facilities are sited is something that I would look to improve. And too often we're seeing that solar is placed on these prime farmlands, prime forest lands, when there is less productive land that's adjacent or nearby. It may not be as big of a plot, but still there's opportunity to put that land into solar if that landowner saw fit. And so at the bottom line, not all farmland is created equal, not all forest land is equal in terms of its productivity or its opportunity for solar or continuing that in production or conservation. So really just want to really kind of nail that down in a way that these projects are sited. I think that's really important to take a look at.
Yeah, and to answer my own question, what I would do is I would change the state income tax code to remove incentives in the tax code for developing forest and prime farmland and create new incentives to dramatically shift development toward subprime farmland and brownfields and already developed properties, including rooftop and parking lots. So, again, thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have one.
This is really fun.